Chapter 6. You might be buying a Ferrari. It was 5:58 p.m. on March 22nd. Trump had just ascended the dais in the White House briefing room to update the nation on the hunt for supplies, when a New Jersey used car salesman watching from home texted an accomplice. "I think we are finally at a point of desperation, where institutions and governments are willing to consider our pricing," Ronald Romano wrote to a friend, whom federal prosecutors would later refer to as Co-Conspirator 3. He was referring to an alleged plan to sell masks at obscene markups to New York City at its time of greatest need. With a potential payday still being worked out, Romano hung on to the words of the president. "In these whirlwind days, the White House coronavirus briefings offered a double whammy to the American psyche. The non-newspaper-reading public was often left to decipher truth from spin, hoax from reality, with help from televised experts of varying intellectual quality. Almost daily, the facts of the situation contrasted with the increasingly obvious lies of our president. Yet on this day, Trump managed to stick to the script. I want to assure the American people that we're doing everything we can each day to confront and ultimately defeat this horrible, invisible enemy," Trump told the American people. "We're at war. In a true sense, we're at war. And we're fighting an invisible enemy. This will be a great victory," he continued. "This is going to be a victory, and it's going to be a victory that, in my opinion, will happen much sooner than originally expected." As the president announced a wartime footing against COVID-19, most Americans registered bad news. The U.S. death toll was creeping into the hundreds and trending toward the thousands, with tens of thousands of confirmed cases, no vaccine, supplies running short, hospitals in New York City filling up. The country was at war with a virus, and also with itself, as cities and states and the federal government fought behind the curtain for the same supplies. But Romano and others like him saw dollar signs. Increased national spending, acknowledgement from the White House of rising infections in California, Seattle, New York, and elsewhere, all could be a boon for business. And it would be a shame to let a good crisis go to waste. Just days before the White House briefing, according to court records, Romano had elucidated his ambitions in a text message to a business partner that read, "I'm working on a few deals that if I get any of them, masks, you might be buying a Ferrari." It was an absurd plan with a peculiar cast of characters. Romano, then 58, had no apparent experience sourcing medical supplies, nor experience contracting with New York City or any other government agency. Yet, emails and text messages later obtained by federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York showed he had decided early in the outbreak to endeavor to sell millions of 3M N95 masks at a cost of about $4 apiece, about four times the usual street price. To do so, he enlisted a friend who resurrected a defunct business through which the group could sell masks. To broker the deal, he leaned on another well-connected associate who happened to be the former foreign investment minister for Macedonia. Yes, this really happened. But about a half hour into the White House briefing, Romano began to worry that his plan might unravel. Navarro, Trump's trade advisor, and one of the first in the administration who took the virus's threat seriously, took the podium to discuss the Defense Production Act and the administration's light foot on the pedal, which some criticized as insufficient. The Korean War-era law empowers the federal government to compel U.S. companies to produce goods needed to protect the nation, giving the government first dibs on those supplies, and activates criminal penalties for hoarders and price gougers. It is an extreme, if necessary, tool, and one that promises to foment significant political hubbub. The Trump administration had thus opted to use these powers surgically, limiting any perception that it wasn't friendly to business while highlighting cooperation from the private sector. "The Defense Production Act, sir, has given me quiet leverage," Navarro said, looking up to Trump at his right. "When you have a strong leader, you can take a light hand initially. So what we've seen with this outpouring of volunteers from private enterprise, we're getting what we need without putting the heavy hand of the government down." While companies like General Motors had already made moves to begin producing ventilators, later that week Trump would formally invoke the DPA to compel manufacturers to produce supplies. But it was what Navarro said next that caught Romano's attention, 200 miles away in Manalapan Township, New Jersey. "The last thing I will tell you is that I also get a lot of calls that are very disquieting," Navarro continued. "Brokers are offering millions of items, whether they're goggles, masks, or whatever. And you go through three different brokers, tracing to a warehouse in L.A. that's allegedly got 10 million masks, and they want to charge you seven times what they cost. That's price gouging. A message to the hoarders," Navarro continued. "If you got any large quantities of material that this country needs right now, get them to market or get them to us. We'll pay you a fair price. But if you don't do that, we're going to come for you and make sure that doesn't happen in this country." Just then, Romano picked up his phone and sent a typo-laden text to the broker helping him secure a potential mask deal with New York City, later identified by federal prosecutors as co-conspirator 2. Romano: "Trump press conference not promising for us." Co-conspirator 2: "What did they say?" Romano: "Going after brokers. If you're hoarding medical supplies, come forward with fair price and they will pay. If not, we will get you." What's funny about this exchange is that Romano and his group were not hoarding, or even conspiring to hoard in any real sense. That's because you can't hoard products that don't exist. Romano didn't have any 3M respirators, nor did he have a real chance of getting N95s out of 3M's headquarters in St. Paul, Minnesota. Rather, as a special agent with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan would later allege, Romano had fabricated a document claiming he had access to 7 million masks as a distributor. In an unusual sidestep of the standard procurement process, the city of New York had signaled that it would be willing to wire payment for medical supplies up front, before anything was delivered. This gave the city an edge over the competition, which was fierce, but also exposed the city to obvious risks. The bulbous 3M N95 and its variants were the most coveted of the disposable respirators. It is the standard bearer. The first respirator, different from a traditional surgical mask in that it was designed to filter out harmful particles to protect its wearer, as opposed to blocking spit to protect, for instance, patients undergoing surgery. Though the concept of using masks to stop the spread of contagion can be traced back to the bubonic plague, the 3M respirator is only a few decades old. Building on the basic concept of fabric masks developed during outbreaks in the early 20th century, this new mask consisted of melted polymer blasted onto microscopic fibers, creating a haystack of sorts through which bacteria and dust particles became trapped. This more involved process provided filtration far exceeding fabric, while still allowing its wearer to breathe somewhat normally. Its earliest applications in the 1960s and 70s were for industry, protecting workers from harmful particles such as asbestos. The female inventor of 3M's N95 built on the design, inspired by, of all things, a bra cup. Soon after, the company added an electrical charge to the cupped fabric, which assisted this haystack with a static that grabbed bad stuff. This mask now filtered out 95% of particles. As it was applied more in hospital settings, during outbreaks of tuberculosis and for protecting immunocompromised HIV/AIDS patients, industry standards and government testing and regulation followed. Competitors emerged, but 3M's model remained top dog. By spring 2020, the 3M N95 was so sought after and so prominently featured in news stories that it became perhaps the most enduring symbol of this most painful year. The thick, white fabric bra cup, yellow bands, the ever-important stamp of approval by the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH. As such, the 3M N95 was the subject of the most audacious and elaborate, if completely batshit, schemes that would arise in the coming weeks and months. Counterfeits entered the market. The volume of false claims from would-be profiteers that they had achieved the coveted status of being named an official 3M distributor, or that they had secret caches of millions of respirators, was such that the company devoted an entire team to help potential buyers determine who was phony and who was legitimate. Through emails and phone calls, the company fielded inquiries nonstop from buyers, brokers, government officials, and law enforcement. The company would begin suing people and companies that were peddling counterfeits or striking deals outside the company's price limits. Cities and states, left to their own devices, established amateur processes and teams for weeding out this type of fraud. It required the squandering of enormous resources at the worst possible time, at an incalculable and profound cost to taxpayers, and the mental health of ordinary civil servants. In New York City, the fishy inquiries were fed to an ad hoc group of purchasing staff that called themselves the GAG team. It stood for I Got a Guy, a mocking reference to the multitude of solicitations filling city emails and voicemail systems that often made reference to a friend or a friend of a friend who had a warehouse filled with masks. From a command bunker in Brooklyn and from cramped apartments scattered across the boroughs, an overtired team of bureaucrats led a monumental effort to help supply masks and other equipment to the city's 56 public and private hospitals. Overnight, invisible procurement officers whose expertise was buying reams of paper, paper clips, and chairs, or managing city real estate, had become disaster aid workers and fraud investigators. Romano's gambit was flagged by a purchasing officer and sent to the GAG team, which suspected his company planned to take the city for a ride. The GAG team confirmed with 3M that the solicitation materials were phony, and the company would sue to shut him down. The GAG team also forwarded his solicitation to the city's Department of Investigation, which built some of the case and passed it along to federal prosecutors. Romano's company offered the non-existent masks at a 400% markup, for a total haul of $45 million. If New York had fallen for it and paid up front, as it did with other vendors who'd run off with the money, Romano and his pals could have purchased fleets of Ferraris. Instead, Romano would be arrested weeks later on 3 felony counts of fraud. He pleaded not guilty, setting off a long court battle. The story of his arrest, a colorful and early example of the sort of opportunism that was transpiring in ways big and small across the country, provided a cautionary tale for mask buyers. But many other ripoff schemes and outright delusional transactions would slip through the ad hoc safeguards set up by hospitals and woefully ill-prepared municipal and state governments. The month of March 2020 could be considered less a unit of time than a prolonged traumatic event. Dozens of people I talked with to retrace those crucial weeks, from different locales and vantages across the country and in varying degrees of frenzy, described the same sort of haze in which their faculties for processing cause and effect, recording the sequence of events, were so assaulted by stimuli they could not keep pace. Still, when pressed, almost everyone who had been called into action could paint in their mind's eye what they were doing as the immense gravity of the situation came into focus. The oh shit moment. Jackie Bray's oh shit moment came around the 15th of March. Her normal job, before COVID, involved advocating for New York City tenants and taking on unscrupulous landlords for the mayor's office. She was not an expert on infectious diseases, supply chains, medical supplies, or hospital administration. But as COVID began to envelop the city, she was called alongside hundreds of others to fill shoes that had never been worn. Organized, hardworking, and respected among her colleagues, Bray was tapped by the mayor to be the city's version of what Admiral Polovchek was to FEMA, the top air traffic controller. She became the connective tissue, gathering up data and new developments from several bureaucratic silos to turn it into information that could be used to make executive decisions and direct resources. The moment hit her as she reviewed models from Cornell, Columbia, and New York University on the predicted spread of infections and the corresponding strain on hospitals. In another life, Bray had been an administrator at the National Weather Service, so she knew to read models with a sort of careful skepticism. They can vary widely, but can help prepare for a reality that may end up somewhere in between the rosiest projection and the worst-case scenario. Any way she looked at it, though, the picture was bleak. Projections estimated the city needed something like 60,000 hospital beds, and fast. Aghast, she looked into the city's data to see how many patients could be taken into inpatient care at that time. Just 20,000. I remember thinking, well, how the fuck are you going to build 40,000 hospital beds in the next 2 months? Bray would later tell me. The city was already shutting down. Broadway went dark. Shortly after her oh shit moment, the New York City schools closed. Then bars and restaurants. Then non-essential workers were ordered to stay home. A city of 8.8 million people, the city that never slept, lulling into a forced coma. But city employees went to work, many of them reporting to the city's high-tech emergency operations center in Brooklyn, aka the bunker. Much of City Hall decamped to the bunker, which is reminiscent of a Hollywood action movie set. It was built with natural disasters such as Hurricane Sandy or a terrorist attack in mind. But it was now the central command for the city's hunt for masks, gloves, gowns, ventilators, and beds. City bureaucrats broke the effort down into three front lines: space, stuff, and staff. Bray knew the city couldn't do much of anything about staff. That was left to hospitals. And there is a finite number of doctors and nurses available. Space. The city could get that. Officials began setting up makeshift temporary hospitals, looking into reopening shuttered hospitals and nursing homes that could house oxygen tanks and beds, and established a secret warehouse for supplies just outside the city. Another team worked to book hotels for an influx of medical staff. Stuff was harder. Stuff they would have to buy, hoard, and make from raw materials. No one knew what they were doing at first. At random, Bray assigned a woman in the bunker to Google for every manufacturer of ventilators she could find, then cold call them and try to buy as many ventilators as possible. They did the same for masks, gowns, and gloves. Bray began the daily gathering of data from hospitals on their inventories and burn rates, information that took some cajoling with private hospital administrators unaccustomed to sharing business information. The delicate balance, the just-in-time method of restocking hospital shelves, was in shambles by late March. By March 25th, the city's hospitals were burning about 3 million N95s a week, an astronomical rate that would worsen with increased infections that were now a statistical certainty. For the next 4 weeks, New York City hospitals would likely need 26 million N95s, Bray warned her colleagues in an email that day. Her spreadsheet indicated the city had in its stores just 1.9 million N95s, which were being distributed in pushbacks across the city. Out-of-work taxicab drivers were being dispatched across the city to deliver N95s and surgical masks to hospitals in small batches. Over the same time period, hospitals would also need something like 640,000 face shields, 1.2 million isolation gowns, and 71 million surgical masks to survive the month ahead. The city had just a tiny fraction of each. The notion of stocking even a week ahead felt like a dream. They'd be lucky to stay a day ahead of being totally naked to the virus. They were trying to outrun a wildfire. Another team raced to award contracts to vendors who could deliver supplies. They coordinated with volunteers and philanthropists who had organized to donate supplies. Officials who oversaw real estate were working with industrial firms in the outer boroughs to produce clear plastic face shields instead of waiting on Chinese shipments that might not come. Officials got one company with a connection to a factory in Vietnam to commit to giving New York City first dibs on increasingly scarce medical-grade gowns. The city's first COVID death had been reported March 14th. And in just 2 weeks, by March 31st, more than 1,000 city residents had perished. By April 1st, there were at least 47,000 confirmed cases. In a press briefing that day, Mayor de Blasio said hospitals needed an additional 3.3 million N95 masks, 2.1 million surgical masks, 100,000 isolation gowns, and 400 ventilators to survive just the week ahead. A massive floating hospital with 1,000 beds, the USNS Comfort, had docked on Manhattan's west side to take some of the strain off city hospitals. That week, Governor Cuomo extended stay-at-home orders. Worried she'd bring the virus home, Bray stopped reporting to the bunker. She would coordinate the city's response instead from a 600-square-foot apartment in the Williamsburg section of Brooklyn that she shared with Bren, her girlfriend of 12 years, and Marlo, the couple's 14-pound black-and-white Havanese. She'd wake to phone calls in the early morning, let some through to voicemail as she showered, post up at her kitchen countertop around 7:30 a.m., and then run through the day's fresh challenges. What is the governor saying? What is the mayor saying? What are the numbers today? By midday, the conversation shifted to tomorrow's crisis. What's coming in? Who needs what? What's going out? They'd brief the bosses and work into the late evening to prepare for the following morning. Rinse, repeat. The days blurred together, none happy with the tight quarters but for the dog, whose scratches increased and whose morning walks were the only normal thing left for the humans. Bray was among the first recipients of the anguish that would soon befall countless other invisible, small government bureaucrats. The failure to prepare at the national level and the vacuum that welcomed aspiring profiteers was cascading down through states and cities that would take turns addressing their own spikes in cases and death. With New York City now the epicenter of the U.S. COVID-19 pandemic, those charged with buying ventilators, masks, and other supplies would unapologetically pursue them in ways that could at once be summarized as reckless, ruthless, prudent, and justifiable. The market for PPE was now accepted as the Wild West. The city was Wyatt Earp. It would protect its own. The gag team and the larger quest for stuff worked under the Mayor's Office of Contract Services, whose chief procurement officer was Dan Simon. He came from a family of frontline workers. Simon's wife was a nurse, as was his sister. Several family members were firefighters. Plain spoken, with a signature New Yorker patois and its accompanying rough edge, Simon had motivations that were visceral and personal. As if that weren't enough, Mayor Bill de Blasio placed continuous pressure on Simon and his team to produce, while acknowledging they faced an agonizing catch-22. If the city signed big contracts that didn't work out, they'd take heat in audits and in the press. If they didn't, potential supplies might go to another city, and New Yorkers could die. The mayor had issued an executive order that threw out the usual contract vetting and gave his people unprecedented power to dip into the public purse. The mayor would keep those powers well into 2021, spending nearly $7 billion without the usual supervision, prompting a lawsuit from the comptroller to restore oversight. "We were in a moral conundrum," Simon remembers, "of having to run down every lead, because what if it really does come through?" By the first weeks of April, the GAG team and other purchasing officers had sorted through thousands of resource offers from middlemen brokers who claimed access to PPE. The city had learned to do some due diligence, requesting FDA certification for any supposed mask lot or proof of authenticity from SGS, a global firm that inspects far-flung products for clients before they might be purchased sight unseen. They requested business filings and proof of life, raw videos that panned over the inventory and often included someone holding a newspaper or document verifying the date of the video. Vendors would send different records, or sidestep questions, or change the product in the middle of negotiations. In all that madness, few, if any, of the leads bore fruit. Simon and Bray realized the city was out of its depth. So the city called in consultants who understood the medical supply chain. The resources offers and the GAG team became less of a priority as the city sought lines from more reputable sources. But the supplies just weren't there. The city's public hospitals had some existing contracts with PPE manufacturers such as Honeywell, but they had none to give. Manufacturing had ramped up, yes, but the federal government had corralled roughly half of what was spitting out of industrial machines, while the rest went to existing and more entrenched hospitals and buying groups. The consultant recommended the city work outside of the entire morass, registering itself as an importer of record so it could work directly with foreign factories, skipping the middlemen vying for a cut or wasting precious time. Miraculously, the city's effort to back up hospitals in their hunt for supplies was mostly working. In dribs and drabs from various sources, the city gathered respirators, masks, and gowns, and sent them on their way, keeping hospitals a day or two ahead of an all-out depletion of supplies. But there would be no reprieve. If the city had masks and respirators one day, it didn't have enough gowns the next. Medical staff were being asked to work impossibly long shifts, while rationing and reusing for many days gear that was designed to be used once per patient visit and then thrown away. To stay ahead of the wildfire racing up their spines, Simon and his team had to beat out the competition, other cities and states. In those first weeks, the fiercest competition hovered around ventilators. While few of the machines were lying around in the United States, it appeared thousands of units were available abroad for the taking. The city issued numerous large contracts for thousands of these machines at exorbitant markups to edge out the competition. Some of these deals blew up in their faces. One was a $162 million deal the city struck with Reef Holdings One LLC, whose Atlanta-based owner, Bernie Tokars, also happens to be a trustee for the Fulton DeKalb Hospital Authority down in Georgia. Tokars had learned of a supposed cache of ventilators collecting dust in Singapore, and through his large business network ended up in conversations first with the state of New York and then the city to import and parlay the machines. They were being sold at a significant markup, plus a commission of about 16% paid to him. Tokars told me that he remembers thinking at the time, "There was opportunity for a windfall here, but I don't want to do anything that would get me into trouble with the law." The state dragged its feet, and Tokars found himself instead talking to Simon and other members of de Blasio's contracts team. The two texted and talked late into the evenings because the sellers were providing updates from the other side of the world. Simon was determined to get the machines, and willing to pay through the nose if it meant beating out the state. Tokars was struck by the rapidity of the negotiations, particularly that Simon and other city staff voiced a desire to beat out Cuomo, who was already amassing notoriety and political capital for his perceived good handling of the outbreaks, which would turn out to be not so good. Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo were famous foes, strong personalities with aspiring loyalists around them. And the dislike had manifested itself in contract negotiations in a way Tokars, who dealt often with local governments, had never thought possible. Typically, civil servants, especially those buying stuff, stay out of the politics. The mayor and the governor don't like each other, and so they were negotiating against themselves, Tokars remembers. It is the most bizarre thing I'd ever seen. And it really left a sour taste in my mouth. Really, the city basically said, "Fuck the state, we want it, we'll pay more." And I'm like, hold on here. The first week of April, the city consummated a deal for 3,000 ventilators, edging out the state. Tokars didn't want money up front, and instead took the purchase order to get financing from a bank that would release funds to the buyer once the goods were shipped. But Tokars immediately backed out of the deal because he, like the gag team and the federal government, had run into red flags. The deal didn't smell right. The sellers couldn't provide relevant certifications. The terms of the deal kept changing. The source would send over bizarre contracts that made reference to Indonesian law. There was just too much risk around the deal. Everything is crazy right now, but the rules of international business still applied, Tokar says. You can't just wire millions overseas without any guarantees or legal recourse. He called to tell the bad news to Simon, who was distraught. Tokars had spent thousands of dollars doing due diligence on a deal for which, luckily, taxpayers hadn't paid a dime. But several other ill-fated deals signed in desperation paid vendors big time. During the frantic buying spree, to beat out competitors and to speed up the influx of supplies, the city paid millions up front to random companies, and I do mean random. The city's deals included an $8.3 million contract for 130 ventilators, an absurd price, with Global Medical Supply Group LLC, based in Boca Raton, Florida. The company, founded by yet another car salesman just weeks before in March 2020, received half of the payment up front, according to court records. The company claimed to be able to deliver 130 ventilators. The company forwarded much of the city's advance to a man in China, whose true business was exporting footwear. The money got stuck in China. The Florida company sued its connection, the city sued the company, and the company countersued, creating the legal equivalent of a venomous snake ball. And taxpayers got bit. In these weeks, Simon ended each night wondering how long he and his staff could sustain. 20-hour workdays, no days off. No one knew how high the case and death counts would go, or when they might abate. Fielding scams and nonsense was a constant and outrageous irritation. The moral conundrum, signing deals that would never fly in normal times, created its own personal and professional burden. It was too much, too fast. And the consequences of every rushed decision could have profound impacts on the lives of his fellow New Yorkers, his own career, and the political fates of two men sparring for the political limelight. Simon packed on 15 pounds that month. Eventually, the city got a handle on ventilators. With the help of the federal government and other sources, the city got more of them. And as knowledge of the virus and treatments progressed, demand for the breathing machines leveled. As the city's procurers tell it, it was the day the ventilator crisis ebbed, or maybe the day after, that they realized they faced a new wave of shortages of a product they never dreamed to surplus. Body bags.